From the studios of KPCW, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley, and in today's show, we have filmmaker Abby Ellis and also author Tor Hansen. Now, today we were going to talk with Alex Riley, who has just written a new book, Supernatural. However, unfortunately, Alex is under the weather, so we wish him well and hope he feels better. We'll have him on the show on another time, but we get to revisit Tor, and I'll talk about it in just a second. But first, our first guest on the show is Abby Ellis. She has just finished, or is working on, in fact, a new documentary about the plight of the Great Salt Lake called Terminal. Abby is an award-winning filmmaker, and Ellis explains more about the fight currently being waged to save Utah's Great Salt Lake. She'll share details about the film and the scientists and politicians who are battling to save the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere as it rapidly vanishes. And then, like I said, we will revisit a broadcast with Tor Hansen, conservationist and Guggenheim fellow and author of a book called Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. He'll explain the who, what, and where behind that and the why. In the book, Hansen explores the remarkable ways that plants and animals are responding to climate change, moving, adapting, and even evolving. It's a story of hope, resilience, and risk in the natural world. And that is all coming up right here, right now on This Green Earth. So stay with us. And welcome back to This Green Earth. And now we have the pleasure of having filmmaker Abby Ellis join us. Abby is a Peabody and Emmy-nominated director who makes films about the moments and institutions that shape us. Her latest work is about the fight to save the Great Salt Lake. Abby will be taking part in the Voices of Nature speaker series, in fact, at Sundance Mountain Resort coming up this Saturday, November 8th, to talk about this subject. And welcome, Abby Ellis, to This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, we are so thrilled you were able to join us before your talk. And as I just mentioned, you are an acclaimed documentary director, and you are known for your work about a film you did about the Flint water crisis. Now you're tackling this crisis that is close to our hearts here in Utah, and that's the peril of our most notable body of water, the Great Salt Lake. So one could say maybe you are drawn to stories of this nature. Is that true? And can you share with us more about your background and what led you to this line of work and particularly the documentaries that you choose?
Yeah, definitely. I actually grew up about an hour outside Flint and lived in Flint for 2 years making that film. And what is so interesting about this film is that, you know, up until this point throughout my career, I've really focused on events after they've happened and looked at places after systems had failed and after government has failed and what are the repercussions of that. That was particularly true in Flint. And what got me so excited about this story is that there's still time to turn it around. And it's not a story in my mind about failure. It's a story, I hope, about hope. And it's a story about people working really hard to figure out what is a really difficult problem. You know, Great Salt Lake, all it needs is water, and that's a really simple solution, but actually getting that water to the lake is much more complicated than that. Most of my work up until this point has been rooted in journalism. So I've made films about, you know, the housing affordability crisis in New York, the Flint water crisis, the Ebola outbreak, police shootings. As I mentioned, stories that expose how systems and governments have failed people. But this story we're telling differently. We're not, you know, we don't have interviews. We're not using narration. We've chose to follow characters and make something a little bit more cinematic and kind of try to reinvent the wheel for how environmental films are made.
Oh, so interesting. So when you say you don't have interviews, you're just going into real moments. Describe to me what you mean by that.
Yeah, it's actually, it's been a challenge because this is such a complicated story that, like, in hindsight, interviews could be helpful. But what we've done is we're following three characters. So we have the Great Salt Lake Commissioner, Brian Steed, who's tasked with figuring out how to save the lake, tasked by the governor. And then we have Bonnie Baxter, who's a microbiologist at Westminster University, who's been studying the lake for 27 years. And then we have Ben Abbott, who's an ecologist and professor at BYU, who started a nonprofit called Grow the Flow, whose sole mission is to also help figure out ways to get water to the lake. So we spend the bulk of our time moving between these three people's stories and following them as they try to navigate what to do, you know, when your home is faced with environmental catastrophe. Like, where do you draw the line? Where do you push? Where do you pull? And so, you know, some of the film is intimate moments with them at home, reflecting on the day. And much of the film is them either uncovering the scope of the problem and brainstorming solutions and coming up against, you know, obstacles as they do that.
So that is really intriguing. You're almost kind of a fly on the wall to see how this is all unfolding. And here in Utah, the Great Salt Lake has certainly been a focus as we see shifts in human behavior and the climate. And there's so much information to get out there when you are tackling this topic. How did you begin this process to embark on making the film? And what were some of those main ideas that you wanted to bring forward?
Yeah, you know, for me, we live in Utah. My husband, I moved to Utah when I was 18. My husband was raised in Utah, and we have a six-year-old son. And so the way that the story came to us is we were just living it, right? We had what was a visible, scary drought in 2022. I mean, we're still in a drought, but that was a really scary year. And, you know, when you have a kid, you're thinking about not just 10 years ahead, you're thinking 20 and you're thinking 30. Mm-hmm. And suddenly Utah felt like a pretty precarious place for our son to grow up, and mostly because of the threat of Great Salt Lake. And for me, I think, you know, there are a lot of people working on this issue, and they've been working on it for a long time. But the audience that I'm most interested in reaching is the average Joe, because the number of people I interact with on a daily basis who have no idea what's going on with Great Salt Lake is truly remarkable. And as a mom of a six-year-old who did, you know, investigate the Flint water crisis and who understands very acutely the impact of heavy metals, for example, being ingested, I know that moms, parents in Utah will care once they understand the scope of the problem. I just think that we have a communications problem when it comes to the lake right now. Not a lot of people know what's going on. So for me, a big chunk of the film is just the problem. Like, how bad is it? You know, what is it? And then towards the end, we start thinking about how can we fix it?
Right. And when we talk about some of these issues and we look at something like the Great Salt Lake, which not only has local implications, but global implications, how do you move forward towards the end of the film, like you had just expressed, with a bit of hope? You know, when we make films, as filmmakers, we want the audience to not only watch and absorb, but we want them to feel. So how are you instilling a feeling of hope moving forward?
You know, in making this film, the last 2 years, I've been in a lot of rooms for a long time with people working on this issue, whether it's the government or scientists or activists. And what gives me hope, and I hope what translates to the viewer, is simple. And that's that not one of these people knows how to quit. These aren't the type of people who give up. And I believe in them. And I think that they are inspiring. So it's the people that give me hope. And I think, you know, Ben Abbott, for example, in the film is a scientist and a well-respected scientist at that. And he, you know, moves between, you know, doing the science and also this question of educating the public. And he says very poignantly in the film, if a doctor diagnoses or, you know, tells you you've got three tumors touching these organs, but then doesn't give you the diagnosis, that's a problem. And as a scientist, I think in the film, we touch on this issue a lot of scientists feeling like they can't go beyond just giving you the information when in fact they can and they should. And so for me, it's just, this is on us, right? And Great Salt Lake only has a couple of years. So it's unlike climate change. The two great things unlike climate change is that one, a majority of this is within our control. This is more of a human consumption issue than it is a climate change issue, which is a huge relief. And two, it's not some far off distant problem. It's happening right now, and it could get very bad very quickly. So that's helpful, right, when telling a story, because I think it resonates with people.
Yes, and I think what you just said there, we can't just put it in that climate change filter always. It's a human consumption issue that we're dealing with here, and it is solvable. And
right.
That is such an interesting lens to look at it. Truly, this is something that is solvable, and it's upon us to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, people, because we live at a time when films are so simple, I would get asked a lot, like, who's the villain in your story? And there's not one. But if there were one, I would say it's apathy, because this is solvable. And so, you know, our first job as journalists, as filmmakers, as scientists, as people in government is to educate the public so that they have the information to save their own lives and to save the future of this place.
Yeah, and a film like this, a documentary like this, it's not an ending point. It's really a starting point for conversation. It's a starting point for change. How long was your process here? How long did it take you to create this film?
My partner and I, who's also the producer on this film, really started thinking about it in 2022. And I think we started filming in 2023. So we've been filming for about 2 years. And we've just finished, you know, we've just submitted it to Sundance. So we're still in the post-production stage, but we're wrapping up.
Oh, great. Well, good luck to you for Sundance. We hope we can see it here in our last Park City Sundance. In making this film, in going through this process for 2 years, there are so many moving parts and pieces, I'm sure. And we talk a lot about killing our darlings when we're talking about films. Are there any stories you can share of your filming experiences that had to hit the cutting room floor, or you wish you could have been included, or it sounds like you might still be in that process?
We are still very much in that process. But, you know, I think what's tough is I am of the opinion that films really shouldn't be longer than 90 minutes. And so cutting it to a duration that I think makes sense for a viewer, while also feeling like each of our characters gets, you know, enough depth, while also feeling like we've explained the problem thoroughly, is a challenge. So, you know, I'm still dealing with that now, but I would say some of the stuff I wish didn't have to hit the cutting room floor are just more intimate moments with our characters, where you really feel for them as people, but might not move the story along so explicitly.
Right. And Bonnie Baxter is very well known for her work here in Utah. How did you find her, and what were some of the takeaways that you received from her?
Yeah, Bonnie is amazing. And she was actually the first person. We were originally going to just do a film about Bonnie, and then it expanded as more stuff started happening. But, you know, Bonnie was in the press and still is a lot talking about Great Salt Lake. And after Joel Ferry at the Department of Natural Resources told the New York Times that the we have an environmental nuclear bomb, you know, in the as Great Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. We really started reading a lot more about it, and Bonnie just was continually quoted. So we reached out to her, and she's been a true collaborator on this project, and it really wouldn't be here without her. What I love about Bonnie in the film is she brings us to the lake a lot, because that's where she does her work. So it's a nice contrast to the politicking that happens, or like the meetings that you see in these like fluorescent lit rooms. She is often taking us to this, you know, beautiful natural wonder that is Great Salt Lake.
Yeah, and to get those different perspectives too on who is working to help solve the issue of the Great Salt Lake, the trio of people, and bringing those perspectives together, all those different ways to look at this.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, even just Bonnie and Ben, they're both scientists and they're both professors, but their arcs in the story are very different. And I think that's okay. I think that's great. You know, it's going to take all of us to do this, and we each need to occupy different roles in order to make that happen. And then Brian, working for the state, is also obviously occupying a very different role. And oftentimes in the film, they'll push back on each other, and that's good too. You know, what I also like about this is you have Republicans and Democrats working together, right? This isn't a film that's about one side. It's about both sides trying to figure out how to solve this. And I think that's uniquely Utah. And I think that's something I hope people can take away from the film that's inspiring at a time, you know, where we are so divided.
Yeah, we all have to think about our future, and we rely on the Great Salt Lake in ways that we are finding, like you said, there's this education to how much we actually rely on this lake and what those ripple effects are should it continue to diminish. And both sides of the aisle need to come together around this. So you were finding that is what it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been really cool to watch. I mean, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, just recently, you know, the governor with the philanthropic community in the state announced a $200 million pledge to begin rescue efforts to save the lake. And and that was a very cool meeting to be a part of, because you have the Speaker of the House, the, you know, Senate President, a lot of important people within government and the philanthropic community coming together saying, you know, we are not going to let the Great Salt Lake die. And that meeting culminated very much as a result of the hard work in part that people like Ben and Bonnie are doing day to day. So, you know, this really is an example of these environmental issues that we are up against. Our fighters are not just on the left, they're also on the right. And we can work together to solve these problems. In fact, we have to, or else we're not going to solve them at all.
Right. It's coming together around this that will really push us all forward. So you are going to be speaking this Saturday, November 8th at 6 p.m. at Sundance Mountain Resort. And it is their Voices of Nature series that you'll be a part of. Tell me about what people can expect if they go to that talk.
I will show about 7 to 10 minutes of the film and talk a bit about what I learned in the filmmaking process as it pertains to Great Salt Lake and where we're at, as well as take questions from the audience. So it'll be a pretty casual event where, you know, we talk about Great Salt Lake and what's needed and how we can move forward.
Fantastic. And you can get tickets for that at SundanceNatureAlliance.org. That, again, is this Saturday, November 8th. It starts at 6 p.m. You can hear Abby Ellis talk about her film Terminal, about the Great Salt Lake for the Voices of Nature series. And that is at Sundance Mountain Resort. Well, Abby Ellis, thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth. We look forward to seeing this film. And good luck to you as you finish it. it. We appreciate you putting something like this out into the world.
Thank you so much.
And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And we are now welcoming to the show Tor Hansen, who is a biologist, conservationist, Guggenheim Fellow, and author of Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. Welcome to the show, Tor.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, first, let me just say, I think in your writing, it's very clear that you have a passion for your line of work. And I want to first talk about you and what led you down this path and how did you enter this world into conservation biology?
Oh, well, it traces all the way back to a whole series of salamanders and frogs and snakes and things that I would catch as a child. I was always that kid with something in a terrarium someplace. So I've always had an interest in the natural world and also always had an interest in writing. So when I was an undergraduate, I did a double major in ecology and writing. And then the science side of things sort of took over from there. And I went on to do my doctorate and so forth in conservation biology. But I always had that interest of the writing as well. So for a while, I was telling myself every time I wrote a scientific paper, I would write a popular article explaining it. And that lasted for about one paper. But it's just too busy to do it all. But later, after some period of time, I got the chance to write a book and devote myself full time to the writing. And in the decade or 15 years since then, I've started spending more and more of my time on that communications part of things, being a what I like to think of as a storyteller of science.
And you are that. And we want to get into this book, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. First of all, the title in and of itself is so intriguing. What led you to write this book?
You know, well, the book was inspired in part, I have to say, by this iconic image that I think we can all imagine on our heads right now. And it is the polar bear stranded on a lonely iceberg that is melting all around the bear. This is sort of our iconic go-to picture for the impacts, the biological impacts of climate change. And I've always looked at that and thought, but there's so much more. That's so incomplete. Our conversation shouldn't stop there because the biology is really at the heart of all future climate change scenarios. It's not just that the climate is changing. It's how plants and animals respond. And, you know, if every species on the planet got along just fine in any kind of weather, then you could tweak the climate around all you wanted, and it would hardly make a difference. But of course, we all know that's not how nature works. There is this great diversity of creatures and so forth on the planet that are all specialized to particular environmental niches. And when you start to change the climate, they respond to try to find a path forward. And that's what I really wanted to explore, was to expand our conversation around those biological reactions to a changing climate.
I saw a quote from you that you said, though rooted in climate crisis, this is not a crisis book. Can you share what you meant by that?
Yes, absolutely. I wanted to shine a light not only on the creatures that are struggling to adapt, but the creatures that are surprising us with their flexibility, with their plasticity in nature, their ability to respond to changing conditions. And so I tried to take a very clear-eyed view of these examples and look for what's really happening, what we can measure and see in the field right now. And so some of the stories are, you know, surprisingly hopeful as well. And so that is what I mean, in that it's not just about the crisis, but also about some of the surprising hopeful signs that we see, at least for some species in nature.
What is it about certain species that allows, say, one type to adapt while others struggle to adapt? Is there common elements in that?
That is such a great question. Oh, and how many hours do we have on this program? This is great. Right into it now. No, you've really hit on it. And that's one of the reasons that climate change biologists focus on this stuff, is to try to, in a sense, tell us what species we need to worry about. Because some species are clearly better equipped than others to deal with this period of rapid change. And when we start to look at it with that lens, we see that specialists, those species that have gotten really good at doing some narrow thing in nature, are the ones that are struggling the most. Whereas the generalists, the jack of all trades sort of species, have more tools in their tool belt to deal with change. And that's an important distinction in that if you look back over evolutionary time, those sorts of general strategies, if you will, always wax and wane in nature, in that there are advantages both ways. If you are in a period of stasis where things aren't changing for a long period of time, specialization is a really good trick to develop because it'll give you some sort of an edge over the other species you're competing with. I live in the Pacific Northwest, and we look at our resident orcas, our resident killer whales, several pods that have become particularly good at catching one type of salmon, and they're better than anything out there in nature at catching that one kind of salmon, which is a great strategy during a period of stasis when there were plenty of salmon and things weren't changing. But now we have climate change in addition to overfishing and the loss of habitat for salmon, and that specialization then in a period of change is a liability. Whereas if you look then at other species who have taken more of a generalist approach, they're in a better situation to adapt to a changing climate. So we see that right now as we go through this period of change, that those species long term that have been generalists have an edge.
Yeah, and I'm curious, because you've spent decades in field projects in biology, at what point do you remember really that shift, that everything was, you're looking through this lens and your research through climate change instead of just field biology?
I think this has happened to pretty much every biologist out there. I think you can say with some certainty that all biologists are studying climate change right now. Some of them just don't know it yet. And that is that if you are out in nature, seeing how plants and animals respond, whatever you're studying, you know, in all these fields of biology, all these different specialties, you're seeing things change quickly, and you're seeing the responses. So one of the underlying themes that I took from my research for this book, which was not only things that I had studied in the field, but also talking with a lot of scientists doing interesting field projects. And what happens again and again now is people go out into the field expecting to study one thing, and they find that things are so different than what they expected that they come back with a very different data set. Their questions have changed and their data have changed. And as a great example of that, I like to point to this project that was going on in Kodiak Island, where they were studying the brown bears, and they were fascinated by how these brown bears always seem to manage their time so well and always be at a particular stream during the peak of the salmon run. So they had gone out and they radio collared a bunch of bears, and they were out there and they were getting their data, and it looked great. They were counting the fish in the stream. This was all lining up perfectly. And then right in the middle of their field season, the bears just disappeared. They left all the streams. And they thought, well, what on earth is going on? And luckily they had radio tagged these bears, or at least some of them, and so they could follow them, and they realized that the bears had left the streams, they'd gone up into the hills to feast on a particular kind of berry, the red elderberry, right? Which happens to be now blooming and then fruiting weeks earlier than it used to because of climate change. And so in this scenario where we have this image in our heads that a bear will do anything for salmon and nothing else, you know, it's happy as Larry eating salmon. It's not going to do anything to change that. At the peak of the salmon season, a bear will leave the stream if there are elderberries ripe. And it led to this different set of questions about how good food for bears, elderberries happen to be. They're strange berries. They're not sweet at all, but they have a lot of protein. So they really do balance out the bear's diet in a way that a high protein food like a salmon, you know, there are a lot of salmon around, so they eat them, but they have a hard time gaining a lot of weight on salmon. And so if you've got something that combines proteins and starches the way these berries do, oh, the bears, they just leave the streams and they go right up there. And that is a classic example of how this climate change sort of overarching influence on all of these natural systems is altering what we study, altering how we understand nature, even something as classic as a sort of bear-salmon relationship, which we really thought we had figured out.
So staying in the Northwest, if an orca is an example of, as you described, kind of a specialist, the generalists, I was thinking maybe those bears, brown bears, could be considered generalists, or maybe sea otters, examples of generalists as far as their diet goes, that they can eat scallops, and now they seem to be loving the green crabs that are beginning to populate that area, those waters more. I'm not sure why the green crabs, Matt, it's a separate story, are suddenly showing up, but are otters with a diversified diet considered more generalist?
In diet, in that regard, yes. Yeah. Or if you look at, species, well, like your bear, the bears, for example, generalists. They'll eat berries, they'll eat clams, they'll eat fish, they will eat, you know, they will scavenge, they'll do whatever it takes, you know. So those sorts of are now extremely valuable, and you see it really in that bear example. Okay, you know, they've got the salmon going, but they can go and shift to berries and put on even more weight than they were putting on when they were eating the fish. So that's, yes, you're right on it. You want to look for those species that if you're sort of in a period of, you know, conservation biology triage, you're looking to help the species that need it the most, and those are the ones that have specialized in general, or have some aspect of their life cycle that is particularly afflicted by the changing climate.
Okay, but again, that, so their diet might be generalized, but perhaps their habitat might be specialized too. So is that another element? And maybe you can, you know, and climate becomes a challenge too. If some creatures, well, birds can migrate, you know, and actually go from, you know, one climate to another. So generalization and specialization becomes a real matrix of elements, components to it to solve. And they may have four or five of them, of those elements solved, but the fifth one might be a real problem for them.
Absolutely. It's extremely complicated when you start to really narrow in and focus on some creatures, particularly examples of plants or animals that have, you know, complex life histories. I mean, if you look at something, since we're doing, we're sort of on this Northwestern kick, if you look at the Pacific salmon, you're looking at a species that interacts with major biomes that are changing in different ways throughout its life cycle. You know, it starts life, and it can be in a mountain stream, and then it goes down to an estuary and out into the near shore and then out into the deep pelagic ocean, and then do that whole trip in reverse. And all of those different habitats are responding to climate change in different ways. So yes, you have, you know, this matrix of problems that species are facing. They can be dietary, they can be habitat related, temperature related, and it's any one of those that can make life difficult for them in a changing climate. A really interesting example as well, just to bust out of the Northwest for a moment and get to the desert, down a little closer to where you are. You said you're down in New Mexico right now, in Utah and so forth. Well, if you go down to the Mojave Desert, you might think to yourself, well, hey, you know, The species here should have it made. I mean, they're already living in the hottest place in North America. Why is climate change a problem for something like a Western fence lizard living in the Mojave Desert? And this research was done by a group led by Barry Sinervo, who's a wonderful herpetologist and a terrific fellow. And he and others were, I think they were sitting around at a conference and they started talking about this problem because they had noticed that some of these fence lizard populations that they knew about and had studied for years were sort of winking out in hot parts of the Southwest. And that got them started on this research project where they tried to figure out what was happening. And they learned that, in fact, you know, when things get hot, the response of lizards, who are what we say in biology, heliotherms, they regulate their temperature with the sun. They, you know, go into the shade. That's what they always do. You see it on a hot day. If you've ever tried to catch a fence lizard, you know it's going to scurry under a rock. They're never very far from a rock because part of the reason they stick close to that habitat is so they can get out of the sun when they get too hot. So if you crank up the temperature, they've got a response. They just spend more time in the shade. But if they spend too much time in the shade, it impacts how much time they have to forage for food. And so they got enough data to be able to predict and find this crux point where if the lizards were spending more sun, they weren't getting enough calories, particularly the female lizards. So if you spend too much time under a rock and you're a female lizard, you do not add enough calories to your diet to be able to reproduce. You can't mate and carry, you know, there are various strategies for those lizards. Some give live birth, some don't. But, you know, at any rate, you can't mate. You can't reproduce. And it doesn't take, you know, the PhD in herpetology to know what the ultimate result of that is going to be. If there's no reproduction, these populations are winking out. And so they were able to make that connection and to figure out that in this case, it's not the direct impact of heat. They've got a strategy to deal with heat. They've been doing it forever. But if you do that on a few hot days a year, no big deal. But if you do it consistently as the temperatures rise, you can't reproduce. And so these questions are fascinating, and it's very revealing and instructive to see what species respond, how they respond.
You've been in this field for so long. Was there anything that you uncovered that literally kind of took you back, or you weren't expecting at all? Or was that across the board?
You know, there were a lot of surprises along the way in the work for this book, in that, and I think it's indicative of how many surprises biologists are encountering in their work right now because of how things are changing. And one of them that stuck with me was the example of the dove keys or little auks, which are a beautiful little seabird. If you can imagine that iceberg scenario that we talked about on the top, and if you push the polar bear to the side and peered over the edge of that iceberg, you might see a dove key, also called a little auk, which is a little alcid, a beautiful little seabird, feeding along the edge of that ice floe, because that has been their strategy for thousands of years. Where that fresh water is melting and combining with the sea water, there is a good place for the zooplankton and so forth that they feed upon. So this has been their strategy. They've been doing it for thousands of years. But scientists have been worried about them in a warming planet because they breed on rocky islands, places like, in Greenland and so forth. But the, you know, a classic for them is the Franz Josef Land Archipelago in Russia. But if you look at those places now, the sea ice is retreating farther and farther from the island. So those adult birds are not going to be able to reach the edge of the ice, in an efficient way to feed their chicks that are sitting there at the nest on the island. There's a pretty easy formula there. At some point, the round trip is just too far and the chicks starve. And again, you see a population suffer. So they have been sort of a poster child at risk for climate change for a long time. But when a group went up there to Franz Josef Land to study this, they were stunned by what they saw. They put, again, radio tags on these little birds. They'd done this in other places, and they knew how far birds could fly, and they had their hypotheses and expectations. And then they got their first bit of data, and they're up at this, abandoned Soviet-era research station in these cold little huts, and they're crowded around with their Russian counterparts, and they open up the laptop and look at the first day's data. And the birds had been in the air. Now, they were expecting, an hour to reach where the sea ice was. The birds had been in the air round trip 4 minutes. So where are these birds going? So they're totally stunned. And they realized that something totally different was occurring, and that at the mouth of the fjord on this island, you could see where the glacial meltwater from the glaciers on the island was mixing with the seawater. It was just that milky glacial water hitting the dark waters of the Arctic Ocean there. And at that point, where those two kinds of water, two densities, two sorts of water impact one another and mix, for the little copepods and crustaceans swimming through the ocean, that is like swimming full speed into a brick wall. And it's a pileup, right? They're just thousands of them there, stunned or even dead. And for the dovekies, it's a bonanza. So here they had been expecting their dovekie populations to be crashing, and in fact they found that they were thriving, and flying just right on their very doorstep was this incredible food source that had been created as a byproduct of the warming climate. So in this case, they calculate that with the rates of glacial melt and so forth going on there, that those dovekies have bought themselves 100 years, maybe even 200 years time to find other ways to adapt to this changing climate. Because that old strategy of feeding on the edge of the pack ice was a losing strategy as the ice got too far away. But they were able to pivot to something brand new.
We're speaking with Tor Hansen. He's a biologist and author of a number of books, including the one we're talking about today, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid, The Fraught and Fascinating Biology of Climate Change. So Tor, let's talk about the title characters, Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid. Have at it.
it's a funny thing in the title. We'll often go out and lecture about a book, and I often spend the first part, explaining the idea behind the book and explaining this and that. And I realized with this book, if I can explain the title, then people will understand the premise of the book completely. So we've got two examples wrapped up in that title. And I'm going to start with the squid first, because we've been talking already in our time together about a lot of rapid adaptations that various creatures have made. And in biology, we call that ability, sort of the inherent ability to change quickly, plasticity. And if you remember the old comic book character Plastic Man, well, here was this fellow who could stretch his body into any shape at moment's notice and solve crimes in imaginative ways. Well, we wish that all species out there were like Plastic Man now to be able to adapt to climate change. But what this really means is the built-in ability to adapt. So it's already something that's within the DNA of a species that they can pivot on a dime, like those dovekies, with a behavioral response or even a physiological response in some cases. And if you were to have sort of an Olympics of elasticity, the Humboldt squid would be on the podium, probably taking gold, maybe silver or bronze, but certainly on the podium as Olympics, because the Humboldt squid reacts in such a dramatic fashion to a warming ocean. If you look down in the Gulf of California, there's been a traditional squid fishery for years. If you, order squid in a restaurant, you're often getting a Humboldt squid. They also call it the jumbo squid because they're so large. They can be 6 feet long, these amazing creatures. So there's been a fishery for them for decades. And then they just disappeared following a couple of marine heat waves that swept through that area, these climate-driven events that have continued and warmed the waters of the Gulf of California and the squid were gone. And so, you know, everyone figured, the fishers and so forth, figured that the squid were responding the way so many species are, by picking up and moving, looking for their comfort zone, looking for the water temperatures they're used to. They went somewhere else. But when biologists actually looked for the squid, they found they were still there in abundance. But they had responded with this plastic response to the warming waters. Something in either the egg or larval stage of that squid being raised in a warmer ocean triggered a different growth pattern and a different lifestyle. So that the squid were maturing in half the time, and they were eating different foods, and they were growing at a different rate, and they were maturing at a fraction of the size that they used to. So you had, instead of these jumbo squid, which could be 6 feet long, you were looking at fully mature breeding population of squid that were only about a foot, 14 inches, tiny little things. So the too small to bite on the jigs that people traditionally used to catch them, which is why everyone thought they were gone. And the few that they did hook, they were throwing back, thinking they were immatures or thinking they were another species altogether. So that is a plastic response, and that ability to have a totally different lifestyle was baked into the squid's DNA.
And that was occurring over the course of one generation or two generations of squid, because I think that's part of the challenge here, is the fact that animals that, you know, their reproductive rates are dozens and dozens of years, or if you're a leatherback turtle, you're not, you know, you're reproducing at very slow rates. I would think that's a big hurdle to come over. But again, going back to these Humboldt squid, they were adapting and building resiliency within one or two generations.
That you've just hit on it, because if you were relying upon evolution to get you out of that fix, you'd need generation after generation after generation, and natural selection weeding out those few individuals weeding out the individuals that couldn't deal with warm water and focusing on the ones that could. The key to plasticity is that it's already there. So this is a one generation shift. And in fact, if you can imagine how this may have developed, you're looking at a species of squid that has a huge range in nature, you know, all the way up in from the North Pacific down to the South Pacific. So over the wide range of that population, they are exposed to different ocean conditions. And so the gene pool, given the mixing in the population that has developed over time, has a lot of variability built in to the individual. So that if you could imagine having a tank of squid, Humboldt squid breeding, you could more or less control the size of those squid by adjusting the water temperature. In that, during that egg or juvenile stage, or larval stage, I should say, that early stage, something is triggered either way. And we can recognize this ability in ourselves as well. And I think that's something critical about understanding plasticity. And one of the classics would be during World War II, when there were food shortages and other stresses on the human population in Europe. If you look at the growth rates of people during that period of time, you know, children that were born and exposed to those stressful conditions in the womb and in early childhood took different life strategy. They were short in stature as they grew older. Even if they were exposed to greater amounts of food later in childhood, those early years put you on a particular track in terms of your physiology. It's almost as if something about the environment triggers a response in the genetic code saying, this is a stressful situation. And if you grow to full size or to the maximum potential, it's going to be hard to support that body size. So we're tracking on a different, slightly different track to be smaller. So that's a human example of the same sort of concept we see in those squid. If they're exposed to warm temperatures as an egg or in the larval phase, it switches the developmental track to a small body size, saying, you don't want to be 6 feet long when you grow up, because you're not going to be able to sustain a body size that huge. So you're going to be a small Humboldt squid.
So fascinating. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up there. We have Tor Hansen, who is a biologist, conservationist, Guggenheim fellow, and author of Hurricane Lizards and Plastic Squid with us. And thank you so much, Tor, for all the information that you have given us. Is there a website or a place people can go to learn more about you and your writings?
Of course, yeah, it's torhanson.net, T-H-O-R-H-A-N-S-O-N.net.
And again, super fascinating. We could talk to you forever, and we are going to have you back on the show because you have an upcoming book, and we're excited to do that.
Yes, the next book coming out is called Close to Home, and I look forward to chatting with you about that.
Perfect. Same here. Thanks, Tor.
Thank you so
much. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.